Hi everyone, I'd like to welcome you to the Austrian Circle. This is the program where we talk about the economics of freedom, here on WHOS Stores 91.7 FM. So thank you very much for tuning into my show this morning. We are going to be talking about war on the show today, as I am often wont to do. We heard from Stefan Molyneux last week from the Bitcoin conference over in Amsterdam, and he was talking about how Bitcoin can be used to limit the government's power when it comes to war. You see, if everyone in the country had to actually see what they paid for war, people would be much less prone to go to war. When you actually have to pay for things, then you have to consider whether or not you want to purchase those things. And Bitcoin allows the government to not be able to just print more Bitcoin. The problem with central banks, the problem with the Federal Reserve and other central banks around the world is that they allow their respective governments to print whatever money that they want. And inevitably, the government's going to print more and more money to create more and more warfare. And we saw this in the Great War, the World War I, that really started and ushered in the nation state as a total state, as a total war creation. And it's no coincidence that 1913 is when the Federal Reserve went into actual action. And then in 1914, we had the Great War. And the Great War would have been over much sooner if we did not have a printing press that the government could then just print money to pay its soldiers, to pay for more armaments, to encourage people into this warfare state. And so we are going to talk a little bit about World War I and how war diminishes freedom. And that can be seen during World War I in England. This article is called When the Lamps Went Out by Alistair Painter. This summer marks the centenary of the outbreak of the First World War. 100 years ago, in late July of the hot summer of 1914, Europe ignited. The significance of the war for those living today, especially those interested in individual liberty, cannot be overstated. The four-year conflict left 9 million dead, governments toppled, and ancient monarchies replaced by unstable republics. The United States had become directly active in European affairs for the first time. The 20th century, Mussolini's century of the state, was well and truly underway. By modern standards, the British state prior to 1914 was rather small. In the 19th century, the ability of the government to effectively regulate and enforce was limited, not only by widespread support for a general attitude of laissez-faire, but also by the lack of a bureaucratic administration that could grease the cogs of a centralized state in the manner of, say, Bismarck's Germany. This is not to say that a slow aggrandizement of the state was not occurring. Successive enlargements of the franchise in 1867 and 1884, and the increasing popularity of interventionist political philosophies, chipped away at the laissez-faire state of the mid-Victorian years. The transformation of the Liberal Party from actual classical liberalism into social liberalism, better described as social democracy, had been completed under the leadership of Herbert Asquith. Slowly, a new Britain was coming into being. The vast British Empire was growing vaster still, as was the revenue required to support it. Even so, at home, Britain was still a remarkably liberal place. Relative to the citizens of most countries of the world, the Englishman could still consider himself free from excessive state interference. Nowhere, perhaps, is the ensuing change more famously chronicled than in A.J.P. Taylor's English History, 1914 to 1945, where the historian noted that, quote, until August 1914, a sensible, law-abiding Englishman could pass through life and hardly notice the existence of the state, beyond the post office and the policeman. As to the particulars of life, Taylor notes that the Englishman could live where and as he liked, without any sort of number or identity card. He could travel abroad without any sort of passport or permit, exchange his money for any currency without any limits, and buy anything from anywhere. Conversely, a foreigner could reside in England without a permit and without having to notify the police. No military service was required, and the demands of national defense could be ignored. Although some householders could be called upon for jury service, only those helped the state who wished to do so. Less than 8% of the national income was consumed by taxes. State intervention was limited and existed in the capacity of attempting to prevent the sale of contaminated food and the spread of infectious diseases, imposing some safety limits on factories, limiting the number of hours that men and women could work in some industries, and attempting to provide an education for children up until the age of 13, as well as those social liberal measures outlined above. The essential change wrought upon life by the war was one of the relationship between individual person and the state. The people became, in Taylor's words, quote, active citizens shaped by orders from above. This meant service to the state rather than the pursuit of one's own interests. 5 million people were conscripted for the war effort. Domestically, the age of central planning had begun. Food was limited and regulated by the state. Pub licensing hours were limited, and beer was watered down. Movement and work were restricted and regulated. As news became controlled, so did every part of the minutiae of life, from the brightness of the streetlights to the time on the clock. Taylor made perhaps the most important conclusion the historian could draw from this strange transformation. Quote, the state established a hold over its citizens which, though relaxed in peacetime, was never to be removed, and which the Second World War was again to increase. The history of the English state and of the English people merged for the first time. Nearly all wars serve to aggrandize the state. The First World War just did so to a degree that was hitherto unprecedented. Some did attempt to halt or at least slow the path to destruction. Henry Petty Fitzmaurice, the fifth Marquess of Lansdowne, published a letter calling for a negotiated peace with Germany. Rather more far-sighted than many in government at the time, he thought the prolongation of the war would, quote, spell ruin for the civilized world. In this endeavor, he was supported by Francis Wrigley Hearst, the Cobdenite liberal and anti-statist, who drew up an outline for possible replacement government composed of more old-fashioned liberals than those currently in office. The Lansdowne letter was rejected. The war went its course, and Britain, of course, was on the side of the victors. As far as the old concept of the limited state was concerned, both liberals and conservatives lost. Emboldened by the influence they had enjoyed during the war, social and economic planners were ascendant. In many ways, the Great War represents the destruction of a civilization, the old order, and its replacement with the modern state and its dilettante reach into every aspect of life. Upon the outbreak of war, British Foreign Secretary Sir Edward Grey is said to have remarked, quote, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime." As a century of relative peace was coming to an end, the lamps really were going out, and with them, the most liberal age the world had ever known. That article was by Alistair Painter. It was posted on the Freedom of Economic Education, FEE.org, and you can find all sorts of great articles. Their magazine is called The Freeman. And so that article really outlines that war really destroys freedom. War is the ultimate destroyer of freedom. We as libertarians understand that war is a violation of property rights on a grandiose scale, not only for those people who are inhumanly called collateral damage and who we would call innocents who are slaughtered in war. Additionally, there are more innocents killed in war who are destroyed because their living circumstance was destroyed. Maybe their business was destroyed. There are also times when the government has blown up sanitation places, hospitals, water treatment facilities, things that people need, power generators. And this is meant to get the civilian population to overthrow their own government because they're in such discomfort. But we see people dying from this. We see this happening in the Iraq War in 2003. They targeted the water treatment facilities, and lo and behold, people did not have water, and so they died. Economic sanctions are another example of this kind of roundabout way of killing people through war. When you impose sanctions on people and they cannot get food, such as also what happened to Iraq in the 90s, they cannot get medicine, they can't get basic antibiotics to heal themselves, and a lot of people died. 500,000 Iraqi children were killed with the sanctions on Iraq in the 1990s. And, of course, there is also the property violation of those who pay taxes who would not otherwise pay for the war. People are forced to pay for the military to go around the world and invade countries who would not pay for it otherwise. You know, Stefan, in the last broadcast, talked about whether or not people would still want to pay for the war if they got a bill for $70,000 for the military to go over and invade Iraq. How many people would sign on to that and say, absolutely, we're going to pay this $70,000 bill over the next however many years? People wouldn't do that if they were actually shown first how much of a cost they were going to pay for the war, and also, you know, were they to be morally disinclined to support the war, then they would have the choice, they would have the option to not pay for a particular war. The only just war is a voluntary war fought on self-defense, voluntary in the sense of taxes, that you would pay for it if you prefer to have the war, and voluntary, no conscription, which is unlike many of the wars that we had in the century of the total state, and voluntary in the sense that you are being attacked. You're being attacked by these other organizations. And so speaking of being attacked, we're going to talk a little bit about Ukraine. And a general tactic that the government has used over time is to pretend like they are being attacked and to sell it to the public as such. This happened all throughout time, pretty much, throughout America's history. We've seen this over and over and over and over and over again. Most recently, the Iraq war with the weapons of mass destruction. Actually, even more recently than that, we had Assad's gas attacks over in Syria. Now, that didn't actually lead to a war. Maybe that's why I left it out. But the government said, oh, he attacked his own people, he gassed his own people, which we later found out to be not true. And it's very common that this occurs. They present this kind of propaganda evidence, and they say, we have to act now, we have to act now. And then evidence actually comes out that what they were talking about is not true. The Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam is another example. The sinking of the Lusitania in 1914 to get us into World War I, that was Woodrow Wilson lied to the public about that. Abraham Lincoln lied about the beginning of the 1861 war between the states with Fort Sumter. We also have Polk back in, I forget the exact year, but this was the American-Mexican War, before the war between the states. We also have the Pearl Harbor with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who knew about the attack before it was coming and actually positioned Japan into attacking us by putting sanctions on that country. And we talked about sanctions just a little while ago on the show. So when they talk in Ukraine about this airliner that was shot down, I think we need to be very, very critical, because we have seen this happen over and over and over and over again. So I want to read Ron Paul's article. He's going to talk about what the media won't report about Malaysian Airlines Flight MH17. Just days after the tragic crash of a Malaysian Airlines flight over eastern Ukraine, Western politicians and media joined together to gain the maximum propaganda value from the disaster. It had to be Russia. It had to be Putin, they said. President Obama held a press conference to claim, even before an investigation, that it was pro-Russian rebels in the region who were responsible. His ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, did the same at the UN Security Council just one day after the crash. While Western media outlets rush to repeat government propaganda on the event, there are a few things they will not report. They will not report that the crisis in Ukraine started late last year, when EU and US-supported protesters plotted the overthrow of the elected Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych. Without US-sponsored regime change, it is unlikely that hundreds would have been killed in the unrest that followed, nor would the Malaysian Airlines crash have happened. The media has reported that the plane must have been shot down by Russian forces or Russian-backed separatists, because the missile that reportedly brought down the plane was Russian-made. But they will not report that the Ukrainian government also uses the same exact Russian-made weapons. They will not report that the post-coup government in Kiev has, according to OSCE monitors, killed 250 people in the breakaway Lugansk region since June, including 20 killed as government forces bombed the city center the day after the plane crash. Most of these are civilians, and together they roughly equal the number killed in the plane crash. By contrast, Russia has killed no one in Ukraine, and the separatists have struck largely military, not civilian, targets. They will not report that the U.S. has strongly backed the Ukrainian government in these attacks on civilians, which a State Department spokeswoman called, quote, measured and moderate. They will not report that neither Russia nor the separatists in eastern Ukraine have anything to gain but everything to lose by shooting down a passenger liner full of civilians. They will not report that the Ukrainian government has much to gain by pinning the attack on Russia, and that the Ukrainian prime minister has already expressed his pleasure that Russia is being blamed for the attack. They will not report that the missile that apparently shot down the plane was from a sophisticated surface-to-air missile system that requires a good deal of training that the separatists do not have. They will not report that the separatists in eastern Ukraine have inflicted considerable losses on the Ukrainian government in the week before the plane was downed. They will not report how similar this is to last summer's U.S. claim that the Assad government in Syria had used poison gas against civilians in Ghouta. Assad was also gaining the upper hand in his struggle with U.S.-backed rebels, and the U.S. claimed that the attack came from Syrian government positions. Then U.S. claims led us to the brink of another war in the Middle East. At the last minute, public opposition forced Obama to back down, and we have learned since then that U.S. claims about the gas attack were false. Of course, it is entirely possible that the Obama administration and the U.S. media has it right this time, and Russia or the separatists in eastern Ukraine either purposely or inadvertently shot down this aircraft. The real point is, it's very difficult to get accurate information, so everybody engages in propaganda. At this point, it would be unwise to say that the Russians did it, the Ukrainian government did it, or the rebels did it. Is it so hard to simply demand a real investigation? That article was by Ron Paul. It was posted at the Ron Paul Institute, July 21st, 2014. The next article I have to read is Paul Craig Roberts. He's talking about what happened to the Malaysian airliner. Washington's propaganda machine is in such high gear that we are in danger of losing the facts that we do have. One fact is that the separatists do not have the expensive BUK anti-aircraft missile system, or the trained personnel to operate it. Another fact is that the separatists have no incentive to shoot down an airliner, and neither does Russia. Anyone can tell the difference between a low-flying attack aircraft and an airliner at 33,000 feet. The Ukrainians do have BUK anti-aircraft missile systems, and a BUK battery was operational in the region and deployed at a site from which it could have fired a missile at the airliner. Just as the separatists and the Russian government have no incentive to shoot down an airliner, neither does the Ukrainian government nor, one would think, even the crazed extreme Ukrainian nationalists who have formed militias to take the fight against the separatists that the Ukrainian army is not keen to undertake, unless there was a plan to frame Russia. One Russian general familiar with the weapons system offered his opinion that it was a mistake made by the Ukrainian military, untrained in the weapons use. The general said that although Ukraine has a few of the weapons, Ukrainians have had no training in their use in the 23 years since Ukraine separated from Russia. The general thinks it was an accident due to incompetence. This explanation makes a certain amount of sense, and far more sense than Washington's propaganda. The problem with the general's explanation is that it does not explain why the BUK anti-aircraft missile system was deployed near or in a separatist territory. The separatists have no aircraft. It seems odd for Ukraine to have an expensive missile system in an area in which it is of no military use and where the position could be overrun and captured by separatists. As Washington, Kiev, and the prostitute media are committed to the propaganda that Putin did it, we are not going to get any reliable information from the U.S. media. We will have to figure it out for ourselves. One way to begin is to ask, why was the missile system where it was? Why risk an expensive missile system by deploying it in a conflict environment in which it is of no use? Incompetence is one answer, and another is that the missile system did have an intended use. What intended use? News reports and circumstantial evidence provide two answers. One is that the ultra-nationalist extremists intended to bring down Putin's presidential airliner and confuse the Malaysian airliner with the Russian airliner. The Interfax news agency, citing anonymous sources, apparently air traffic controllers, reported that the Malaysian airliner and Putin's airliner were traveling almost the identical route within a few minutes of one another. Interfax quotes its source, quote, I can say that Putin's plane and the Malaysian Boeing intersected at the same point and the same echelon. That was close to Warsaw on the 330M echelon at the height of 10,100 meters. The presidential jet was there at 1621 Moscow time and the Malaysian aircraft at 1544 Moscow time. The contours of the aircraft are similar. Linear dimensions are also very similar. As for the coloring, at quite remote distance, they are almost identical. I have not seen an official Russian denial, but according to news reports, the Russian government, in response to the Interfax news report, said that Putin's presidential plane no longer flies the Ukraine route since the outbreak of hostilities. Before we take the denial at face value, we have to be aware that the implication that Ukraine attempted to assassinate the president of Russia implies war, which Russia wants to avoid. It also implies Washington's complicity, as it is highly unlikely that Washington's puppet in Kiev would risk such a dangerous act without Washington's backing. The Russian government, being intelligent and rational, would obviously deny reports of an attempted assassination of the Russian president by Washington and its Kiev puppet. Otherwise, Russia has to do something about it, and that means war. The second explanation is that the extremists who operate outside the official Ukrainian military hatched a plot to down an airliner in order to cast blame on Russia. If such a plot occurred, it would likely originated from the CIA or some operative arm of Washington and was intended to force the EU to cease resisting Washington's sanctions against Russia and to break off Europe's valuable economic relationships with Russia. Washington is frustrated that its sanctions are unilateral, unsupported by its NATO puppets or any other countries in the world, except possibly the lapdog British PM. There is considerable circumstantial evidence in support of this second explanation. There is the YouTube video which purports to be a conversation between a Russian general and separatists who are discussing having mistakenly brought down a civilian airliner. According to reports, expert examination of the code in the video revealed that it was made the day before the airliner was hit. Another problem with the video is that, whereas we could say the separatist conceivably could confuse an airliner at 33,000 feet with a military attack plane, the Russian military would not. The only conclusion is that by involving the Russian military, the video doubly discredited itself. Indeed, the entire Western media spoke as one, Russia did it. And the prostitutes are still speaking the same way. Possibly this uniform opinion merely reflects the Pavlovian training of the Western media to automatically line up with Washington. No media source wants to be subject to criticism for being un-American or to find itself isolated by majority opinion, which carries the day and earn black marks for being wrong. As a former journalist for and contributor to America's most important news publications, I know how this works. On the other hand, if we discount the Pavlovian conditioning, the only conclusion is that the entire news cycle pertaining to the downing of the Malaysian airliner is orchestrated in order to lay blame on Putin. Romesh Ratnasar, deputy editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, provided convincing evidence for orchestration in his own remarks of July 17th. Ratnasar's opinion title is, quote, The Malaysia Airlines Shootdown Spells Disaster for Putin. Ratnasar does not mean that Putin is being framed. He means that prior to Putin having the Malaysian airliner shot down, quote, To the vast majority of Americans, Russia's meddling in Ukraine has largely seemed of peripheral importance to U.S. interests. That calculus has changed. It may take months, even years, but Putin's recklessness is bound to catch up to him. When it does, the downing of MH17 may be seen as the beginning of his undoing. As a former Wall Street Journal editor, anyone who handed me this, like Ratner published, would have been fired. Look at the insinuations when there is no evidence to support them. Look at the lie that Washington's coup is, quote, Russia's meddling in Ukraine. What we are witnessing is the total corruption of Western journalism by Washington's imperial agenda. Journalists have to get on board with the lies or get run over. Look around for still honest journalists. Who are they? Glenn Greenwald, who is under constant attack by his fellow journalists? Who else can you think of? Julian Assange locked away in the Ecuadorian embassy in London on Washington's orders? The British puppet government won't permit the free transit of Assange to take up his asylum in Ecuador. The last country that did this was the Soviet Union, which required its Hungarian puppet to keep Cardinal Medinsky interred in the U.S. Embassy in Budapest for 15 years, from 1956 until 1971. Medinsky was granted political asylum by the United States, but Hungary, on Soviet orders, would not honor his asylum, just as Washington's British puppet, on Washington's orders, will not honor Assange's asylum. If we are honest and have the strength to face reality, we will realize that the Soviet Union did not collapse. It simply moved, along with Mao and Pol Pot, to Washington and London. The flaw in Putin's diplomacy is that Putin's diplomacy relies on goodwill and on truth prevailing. However, the West has no goodwill, and Washington is not interested in truth prevailing, but in Washington prevailing. What Putin confronts is not reasonable partners, but a propaganda ministry aimed at him. Washington's propaganda assault against Russia is a double tragedy, because it has diverted attention from Israel's latest atrocity against the Palestinians locked up in the Gaza ghetto. Israel claims that its air attack and invasion of Gaza is merely Israel's attempt to find and close the alleged tunnels through which Palestinian terrorists pour into Israel, inflicting carnage. Of course, there are no tunnels and no terrorist carnage in Israel. One might think that at least one journalist somewhere in the American media would ask why bombing hospitals and civilian housing closes underground tunnels into Israel. But that is too much to ask of the U.S. media. Expect even less from the U.S. Congress. Both the House and Senate have passed resolutions supporting Israel's slaughter of Palestinians. Two Republicans, the despicable Lindsey Graham and the disappointing Rand Paul, and two Democrats, Bob Menendez and Ben Cardin, sponsored the Senate resolution backing Israel's premeditated murder of Palestinian women and children. The resolution passed the, quote, exceptional and indispensable People's Senate unanimously. As a reward for its policy of genocide, the Obama regime is immediately transferring $429 million of U.S. taxpayers' money to Israel to pay for the slaughter. Contrast the U.S. government's support for Israel's war crimes with the propaganda onslaught against Russia based on lies. We are living all over again, quote, Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, Assad's use of chemical weapons, Iranian nukes. Washington has lied for so long that it cannot do anything else. That article was by Paul Craig Roberts. It is available at paulcraigroberts.org. So thank you very much for tuning into my show this morning. I hope that you have gotten something from this, and hopefully that is that war is incredibly destructive, not only for the people where the gun is aimed at, but also for freedom. Politicians often use wars as an excuse to take away people's freedoms. And we have to understand that these wars are generally sold to the people based on lies. So, have a great week. Take care.